Another hello to our podcast listeners. You've probably heard us talk about our social networking site, MyCity. Well, we've added some new features to the site, including a widget for my Twitter stream and an embeddable Smart City audio player so you can add us to your blog or website. If you're not a member of Smart City, send an email to Scotty, the producer of Smart City, and he'll get you set up. The address is scotty@smartcityradio.com. I look forward to seeing you on the site, and now, on with the show. I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today on Smart City, we're looking ahead for a view of the city in the year 2050. Maureen McAvey of the Urban Land Institute will tell us what the city will look like 40 years from now and what changes we need to make the future greener, richer, and most importantly, more fun. And we're joined by Dr. Beverly Hall. Dr. Hall has served as the superintendent of Atlanta Public Schools for a decade and was recently honored by the American Association of School Administrators as their 2009 National Superintendent of the Year. We'll talk about the innovations that are happening in Atlanta public schools and why improving student achievement is no mystery. All that plus the latest news from Plan Edison today on Smart City, right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. What will life in the city be like 40 years from now? My first guest, Maureen McAvey, has a point of view on that. Maureen is the executive vice president of the Urban Land Institute, a not-for-profit organization that has published a study called The City in 2050, Blueprints for Change. And in it, they speak with futurists, engineers, architects, and economists to start a conversation about the future of cities. Maureen, what's driving the changes we'll see in cities by 2050?
Well, there's several things that are enormously important for cities. The first, I would say, is simply the demographic change. We will add easily another 120 to 140 million people into the U.S. Between now and 2050. That's almost an addition. It's well over 100 million more people than we have in the cities today. We have about 300 million people in the entire country. Increasingly, we are a metropolitan nation. So most of the 120, 130 million who will be coming will be living in metropolitan areas, not in the rural or semi-rural areas. An enormous change. On top of that, most of the jobs will be in the cities. We will face climate change. We are clearly going through this economic restructuring period at the moment, from a manufacturing country to a service and intellectual property country. So we will see just enormous changes over the next 30 to 40 years, and we have to figure out how to cope with them.
We have to cope, but there are also some opportunities in those changes. What are the big opportunities for change in cities?
I think some of the opportunities are in the physical platform that we can build differently. We can build more compactly and with more mixed use and mixed income. That does not mean that every city is going to turn into Manhattan with 30 and 40 story buildings, but it means that we can build in a more holistic way. If we build so that transit is a realistic option for people, not every person in the U.S. over 16 needs to own a car. If we build so we think about what we call full-spectrum housing, so that whether you're affluent or whether you're a young person wanting to be in an apartment, or as you age, whether you potentially become single again, as you age, and increasingly we will live to be over 100, you have different needs. There really is housing for you in your community and your neighborhood, regardless of what your income status is or what your household status is. So I think we're going to see tremendous opportunity as everyone talks about the whole green arena and addressing climate change, addressing alternative energy. All of those will be great opportunities for us.
How do you sell the idea of more compact living?
A lot of it actually we have done with pictures, that when you show people pictures of well-designed, attractive communities that in some cases are townhouses with playgrounds, when you show people four-story, six-story buildings that are attractive and have common spaces, and you ask them, would you be interested in living there? Many people, not everybody, but many people would love to live in that environment. They believe they can't afford it. Certainly, Americans are never going to be a one-size-fits-all, but there is a significant survey data that shows that many people would like to live in a different environment than what they currently live in. They believe they can't afford it.
But haven't we been living in a one-size-fits-all society? There haven't been a lot of choices.
That's exactly right. And we're starting to see essentially experimentation occur. And as the baby boomers age, we are likely to see more experimentation, where people live in some communal settings, and not just a assisted living institutional type setting, but where they voluntarily start to team up with each other. We'll see multi-generational housing. We'll see a different kind of stacked flats, as you see in other parts of the world. We'll see communities that want to give more attention to growing vegetables and skylights. So there will be more experimentation over the next 20 years, and we'll see what comes out of that. I mean, we think automatically of townhouses and of mid-rises and high-rises, but I think there are going to be different patterns that people start to look at, and some will be successful and some won't.
Anytime you introduce a new model, it's hard to finance. How do you get financing to do the new things you're talking about?
Well, we are definitely risk-averse as a general proposition, and certainly in the current economic environment, we are quite risk-averse. So banks are not willing to lend on much of anything at the moment. And often there is a role for the public sector or the not-for-profit sector to come in and play a role in what we call mezzanine financing, sort of a layer in between the bank, the traditional lender, and the borrower, so that for anywhere from 10 to even 30% of the overall project costs, there is a layer that tries to mitigate the risk and allows experimentation to occur. So I think we will see some mezzanine financing come in that will look at some of these experiments and try to give it, you know, a fair chance, come in for a five-year lending period or subsidize that portion so that both the marketplace will start to accept these changes and the banks and the financial institutions will be comfortable with the degree of risk in a somewhat untried product.
Why did ULI undertake this work?
We really believe that as we look forward, that we need to think about innovation, we need to think about responsible land use. It is ULI's mission. And we need to think about creative ways of making the future, as CEOs for Cities talks about, fun. And that within that environment, it's not about living with less or being draconian about changes. It's really accepting the best from the big marketplace of the world, where we're seeing incredible experimentation going on all over the world, in China, in Europe, in Middle Eastern countries, et cetera, and trying to choose the best from that, all of those experiments, and bring it back to the U.S. and make the metropolitan areas much more vibrant than they've been in the past. We believe that's our ticket to a successful future.
How did you develop the content?
We did a great deal of what we'd call tabletop research. So part of it was, you know, using the internet and such. We have 40,000 members in 92 countries. So some of that was using our member network and finding creative projects that people are working on literally all over the world. And then we had several forums where we drew in 20 to 30 creative people. Some were architects, some were developers, some were our members, some were not. And we started to have forums and meetings and literally ask them a series of questions, not about what is currently, but what they think will be happening as we go forward. In some cases, we asked what you think the end state will be, what will 2050 look like, and then we asked people how they think we'll get from here to there, what changes will start to creep in, if you will.
What do you foresee gaining the most traction quickly in terms of what the development community will embrace?
I think the alternative energy is not something that is a fad. I think that is going to be a given, and that over the next 10 years, we will simply adopt more energy-conserving mechanisms across the board in the buildings we build, the housing, the retail, the commercial buildings, and in how we choose locations. We'll think about transit alternatives, not just light rail, but bus rapid transit, as well as making buses simply more attractive and speedier. One of the negatives of buses is people don't like to stop at every corner when they're going from point A to point B. So I think we'll see quite a bit of difference on the energy front. I also think we're simply going to start to recognize the changes in demographics, in both the number of people who require new housing, new office space, new retail, and the diversity of those people who not all of whom are going to want the single-family detached house in the suburbs.
What were the big insights from this study?
Part of what was phenomenal to us was to look back 40 years. And when we started asking people what they think the future will look like, you know, no one came up with sort of a earth-shattering, totally new concept until you started to play with them a little bit and ask to look back. 40 years ago, there were no cell phones. 40 years ago, there were no laptops. 40 years ago, people were not working significantly all over the world. They weren't working from home on a regular basis. They weren't doing work, in some respects, on a 24-hour basis, as we are now between BlackBerries and cell phones and laptops. One of the challenges in our modern life is to get away from work occasionally, not to carry it with us on a 24/7 basis. So as you look backwards and start to look at even the physical landscape around you, as we look out our windows and you say, no matter where you are, even in many historic and older cities, how many buildings that you can see have been built or substantially rehabbed in the last 40 years? Most of them. The data shows that 60% of all the buildings that we will need in the next 40 years have not been built. So on a day-to-day basis, change happens slowly. When you look over your shoulder, change has been profound and will be more profound.
Do you think we will come out of this downturn with a significantly different approach to development?
Yes. I think that we are actually going to come out. It's going to be a very painful 2 years and a painful process, but I believe we will come out stronger, with better lending criteria, with a new approach to what you could call community building and city making, so that we can't be as profligate as we've been the last 50 years. We can't be as easily spending of money, of energy, of land. We're not going to be able to sustain that and really manage it effectively over the next 100 years. Young people clearly get that. Some of the creative things that some of the groups within CEOs for Cities are doing speak to that kind of creativity and a different awareness of sustainability and what we're leaving new generations. So I think there will be different paradigms, not 100% different, but a more responsible, thoughtful set of building ideas and of urban ideas.
How has the development community reacted to Cities 2050?
They've been very enthusiastic and have been pushing us and edging us and pulling us to think more specifically about, okay, we get the big concept, now what? How do we really implement this? what are the operational aspects to it? And we're starting to see people in this downturn, you know, when you can, you build, and when you can't, you plan. And so they are planning thoughtfully. They're assessing alternatives at this point. They're looking at energy solutions, looking at demographics, looking at climate change, and really thinking about, as they build master plan communities, as the suburbs expand, as there is infill development, how specifically do you implement these ideas? What are the details of the best examples from around the world?
You just referred to suburban growth, but the book 2050 suggests we are going to push back into the city. Are those two things in conflict?
Oh, not at all, because when we talk about the metropolitan regions, we really, you know, you can't be a suburb of nothing. So certainly when people are away from the city and someone asks them where they live, even if they live in a far-flung suburb, the answer to the question is, oh, I live in Chicago. And they then say, well, I actually live in a suburb 30 miles west or east or whatever it is of Chicago. So the city itself and the suburbs are as connected as they ever have been, and in different ways more connected because of the systems, the infrastructure systems that increasingly tie the cities and suburbs together, and because of natural resources like water and energy grids. So we believe that the suburbs will see a great deal of infill. There will still be some greenfield or farmland type development, but we will see a different form of development going on, particularly in the third and fourth ring suburbs in many, many cities. You'll start to see town centers and more urban villages as opposed to the strip retail that has gone on these major arterial roads that has no center. We're going to start seeing, if you will, mini downtowns and sort of satellite cities, if you will.
What you say works for growing places, but not in declining cities.
It's a huge issue, and it's an issue, I might add, all around the world, not just in the U.S. There are some examples of cities that have created new economic platforms for themselves. We look, for example, to the education and medical institutions, because largely those institutions are major employers. They are the economies of the future, and they are rooted largely where they are. So it is difficult for universities and medical institutions to pick up and move to Arizona or Texas from New York State. We have to rethink creatively how those places find new economies. And obviously there will be winners and losers. We want to try and minimize the damaging effects for those that are losing. But it will take creativity, and some of those cities have very, very weak leadership and will be very difficult to recreate. And there will be significant hardship on people who live in those communities and need good jobs. I mean, we're seeing this in the Detroit marketplace right now, where they are trying to significantly restructure that economy. Many would say that they've been trying for the last 30 years, but this will be very painful, but hopefully quite productive as we come out, you know, in another 10 years or so.
You're talking about the growth in healthcare and education as if that will always continue, but, you know, in some ways, those are both government funded, and I'm not sure that it really makes sense to build an economy on that. I'm not sure we can continue on that trajectory.
If you look around the world at where people are spending money, they are spending it, if you look in China, you look in India, you look in the European Union, they are spending money to educate their young people and to educate them in math and science, engineering, the, if you will, economies of the future. And they are looking at attempting to equalize healthcare so that there is not as much two healthcare states As you know, we probably have in the neighborhood of 43 to 45 million people in this country who are not insured at this point and consequently have inadequate preventive health care and often inadequate maintenance of good health. And so when they get sick, it is often far more expensive to care for them because by the time they go to the emergency room, they are very sick. So the question, and the current administration is currently looking at this, and there'll be big fights about it, to what extent do we set a floor of health care for everyone in this country? And that's, you know, that's going to be the open debate. And how do we set a two-tier system so that if you have more money, you get substantially better care than if you don't have much money and you get a minimum floor of care?
And I know all of that, but is that the way you build an economy?
You don't build an economy on just one aspect. So as we think through what the relationship between the elements of the economy, the education, building infrastructure, building adequate housing, addressing green and climate issues. I mean, as you think about new forms of economic potential and new industries, all of those things fit together. And they come together in metropolitan areas, largely. So how we help people communicate and open up communication so that people have access and have mobility within that metropolitan potpourri, if you will, that's how we will have healthier communities, so that it's not only education and medical institutions, it's not only new green industries, it's not only new engineering, it's sort of all of that and then some.
What did you argue about?
We argued about, were there new big ideas? You know, the language of the futurists these days are, what are the black swans? What are the unexpected things that will come out that no one can imagine? You know, in some respects, 9/11 was a black swan. And people spent time thinking about, are there black swans? And the consensus generally was, the reason it's a black swan is you can't imagine it. It's not what's expected. So that was, in a sense, a diversion because you couldn't imagine it. We argued about how fast the pace of change will occur. And, of course, some people think that it will be much slower than others do. We're sort of, ULI is sort of on the side that the pace of change is going to continue to escalate and the globalization will continue to escalate. We argued about equity issues and social equity and how we make all of society more equitable. And there are no easy answers for this. So it got us into the arguments of greater taxation, more capitalism, how you make people who have less enter, if you will, the middle class or at least a sustainable life. How do you make that happen, whether they live in Africa or they live in parts of South America or they live in parts of our urban communities? So these were lively, to say the least, lively discussions. And we talked about this as a dialogue, that we don't begin to have all the answers, but we think it's very important to start this thought process because we will be seeing these kinds of change. And the more we think about it, hopefully the better the changes will be.
Where did you find the easiest points of engagement?
We found general agreement that the future is in the cities. It is in these metropolitan areas. And that while people like a second home, they like the country, they like a rural or a seashore environment, that the economics will encourage and in some respects force people to largely be in metropolitan areas. And that's true around the world. So that was sort of easy agreement. We found agreement on the goals that generally people want a lifestyle that is good for themselves, good for their families, good for that they have good playground space and park space and good housing and decent mobility and access. So the goals, in a sense, at a broad level, were quite easy. It was the mechanics of getting there that were challenging.
Maureen, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Maureen McAvey is the Executive Vice President of the Urban Land Institute. If you want to take a look at the 2050 research, go to our website, smartcityradio.com. Coming up after the break, we'll have the latest news from PlanEdison's Nate Berg and a conversation with the 2009 National Superintendent of the Year, Dr. Beverly Hall. Stick around for more Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. For the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of PlanEdison.
The bust of the condo market has been a drag for New York City, but officials there are trying to find a bright side to the bummer. State legislators recently announced plans to take stalled or abandoned luxury condo projects and finish them off as affordable housing. City Hall News reports that policymakers are working with housing advocates to find ways to convert hundreds of empty luxury units. Developers are pleased with the plan because they are having a hard time selling or even renting these units, and many are in danger of bankruptcy. Legislators are hoping to work with financiers and property owners to reduce losses and help out the community with much-needed affordable housing. Meanwhile, in Florida, there's another idea for dealing with abandoned and stalled housing developments. Officials at the Trust for Public Land have been scouting a 160-acre site near Tampa where optimistic housing developments have either stalled, fallen flat, or simply been abandoned. According to a recent article in the Los Angeles Times, the Trust wants to undevelop this land and return it to nature using state conservation funds. They hope to restore the native waterfront ecosystem near Tampa Bay by bringing back the palm trees and mangroves that once made this area a vibrant home for birds and animals. But first, they'll have to buy it back from Bank of America, which took over ownership when developers planning to redevelop a portion of the site fell into bankruptcy. Much of the decision lies with the bank, but the Trust for Public Land is hopeful that they will agree to split up the land and allow county taxpayers to make the purchase and undevelop themselves a new waterfront park. And in other news, officials at the Vatican recently announced plans to build the largest solar power plant in Europe. The Vatican's solar array would fully power the Roman Catholic city-state within Rome, according to Bloomberg News. The plant is set to be complete and operational by 2014 and will produce so much energy it will be able to sell the excess back to Italy. With a capability of more than 100 megawatts, the power plant will be able to supply power for about 40,000 Italian households. Vatican officials say the move is part of the church's efforts to bring environmental concerns into the mainstream ideologies of the Catholic Church. And with Pope Benedict XVI gathering press for his stance on environmental issues, Vatican officials say this may be the first of many green moves. For PlanEdison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. In February, the American Association of School Administrators honored my next guest as the National Superintendent of the Year. Dr. Beverly Hall has served the Atlanta public school system for just over a decade, and I began our conversation by asking her how long it takes for a superintendent to start making a difference in an urban school district.
Well, I think it takes at least 3 to 4 years to begin to have the infrastructure in place to begin to see the kind of progress that we've been seeing in Atlanta. I just think when you come in, you have to build a team. You have to convince people that you're not leaving because, as you said, the average tenure of urban superintendents vary from anywhere from 2.5 to 3.6 years. And so most people are waiting to see if you're going to stay before they commit to joining the team. You may have to change that a number of times. You have to establish a rapport and a working relationship with your board, with the community. And at the same time, you have to jumpstart the instructional program, which is our core business and the most important thing that we have to do. So it takes about 3 to 4 years, I think, to just have the basics in place to begin an aggressive transformation of an urban school district.
We visited recently in Atlanta, and you said, we know what to do when it comes to improving student achievement. It's no mystery. Well, it may not be a mystery to you, but it is to most of us. So tell me, what is it we need to do to improve student achievement?
Well, first and foremost, I think we have to have a very high expectations for students, and we have to teach them to high standards. We have to have leadership in the building, principal leadership, that can clearly focus on making the environment one where instruction is the focus, where teachers can get the support they need. And the most important ingredient in this whole equation is the teacher quality, the quality of the teachers who are providing the instruction. And so when you come into a system where achievement is low, where you believe the teachers need additional support, obviously, if they knew what to do, they would be doing it and the children would be learning. I believe the most important thing is to create the conditions and provide the professional development on the ground in the schools using what research says is the best approach to professional development so you can change the way instruction is delivered and students can begin to learn at high levels.
What is it that most teachers need to change to make their instruction more effective?
Well, one of the toughest things for teachers to do is what we call, in our jargon, differentiated instruction. That is, they have to be able to keep the standards high, but take the students from wherever they happen to be to where they need to be, which means they have to be able to, for some students, accelerate the curriculum. For others, they have to go back, fill in the gaps that were missing and still bring them to where they need to be. They have to know how to use grouping, how to use different methodology and different tools, different materials, so that they can get all the students in the class learning to those standards, but learning at the level in which they need to be taught, getting eventually to the same end goal. And it's a very tough thing for teachers to learn to do. We tend to teach to a whole group, sort of the average, where everyone, approaches it the same way. And, of course, the research is very clear that in high-functioning classrooms, we must differentiate. We must use different approaches, different strategies to get the students, however, to the same high standards at the end of the day.
I know groupings and tracking by classroom is no longer approved of, and yet it seems to me that would make teaching a bit easier if all of my children were functioning at the same level, would it not?
Well, you know, when I came into education, at the risk of dating myself, in 1970, that was the common philosophy. And so you had the brighter, quote-unquote, students in one track, and you had the average student in another, and then the students who were struggling were yet in another track. What happened then was we had a dumbing down, for lack of a better word, of the curriculum. The children who were behind were never expected to reach the appropriate standard. The curriculum was watered down, the materials were below grade level, and they tended to stay forever in the bottom track. While the middle kids plodded along, average work, again, very few moving into what we now would call the advanced level track. And the advanced kids just kept on rolling right along. And we got to where we are today with this tremendous number of students not completing high school, some not even completing middle school, because the ones who were at the bottom sort of gave up. There was no end in sight. The work was often just dull, drudgery, drill and kill, no challenge involved. And there was nothing wrong with those kids intellectually. Their skills might have been deficient because they had not had either the prerequisite work in preschool that they needed or the additional tutoring and monitoring in elementary school, but they weren't dummies. So by the time they got to middle school and high school and the work continued to be just low level, redundant, not challenging, they got bored with it and they walked with their feet. So we figured out, meaning educators figured out, that tracking was not a good thing, that we needed to have our classrooms with a wide variety of children in there, and we needed to develop the instructional strategies to meet the needs of those kids. Now, it doesn't mean that you just, if you have a child who's really far behind because they have a learning disability, that that child should not be entitled to special support. And we do that through, of course, the Program for Exceptional Children, Special Education. But the average young person, the student who is behind, if they're taught appropriately, can be brought up to grade level. And Atlanta is living proof of that. And the final thing I'll say, which is, you know, I find amusing when I say to certain audiences, private schools take all the children who they accept and place them in a classroom. All those students are not all gifted students, but all those students are taught to high standards. The curriculum and the teaching is differentiated, and lo and behold, at the end of the day, a large percent of them would be considered high achievers by the time they apply to college. But I submit to you that all middle-class kids or upper-middle-class kids are not born brilliant. We have the same range of abilities as we find in the general population, but they're placed in an environment where every child is expected to meet high standards. And guess what? By and large, unless there is some significant learning deficiency, they do make it.
The Gates Foundation, of course, agrees with you now. They believe the single most important thing you can do to improve student achievement is to put a good teacher in the classroom. You said the same thing. Where do you get good teachers? Now, you talk about continuing to teach teachers and, in effect, remediating teachers or helping them develop good professional skills. But are there enough good candidates in the candidate pool for you to do what you need to do?
I think we have to make the teaching profession much more attractive so that we can recruit and hopefully retain people in our colleges who are much higher achievers than some of the people who now go into education as a major. There have been enough studies out there that show that a lot of education majors are students who fall into the bottom quartile in terms of SAT scores and college grade equivalents, etc. That doesn't mean that we don't still have some others. I don't want to say that every teacher who enters this system is not really very bright. But a lot of people have, education has just not been able to attract the very high-achieving student from our colleges and the students who really want to commit to making this their life's worth. Now we're seeing with things like Teach for America, which we have here in Atlanta, a lot of high-achieving students at least wanting to initially come in and teach. Whether or not they will stay in the arena, we're not sure, but at least we know that many of them have expressed an interest in the profession. We have to make the profession one where they would want to stay once they come in. And to do that, we have to look at how we compensate teachers generally, then whether or not we ought to have some kind of a performance-based or differentiated compensation system for the high performers, whether there is a career lattice within our profession, so the young generation, whoever they are now, X or Y or Z, they are not going to want to do the same thing in perpetuity. So do we have other arenas or avenues within our profession where they can move and not necessarily have to go into administration, but become master teachers, model teacher leaders, coaches, perhaps go back into the classroom after being out for a while? And do we compensate them appropriately? And lastly, is the profession viewed and valued as something that's worthy? I mean, when mom and dad sends me off to Princeton or even, you know, to any school, to a state college, of course, to the Spelmans of the world, the Morehouses, will they be crying when I come home and say, guess what, I've decided to go into teaching, as opposed to if I come home and say I'm going to be a lawyer? And maybe the economic climate's going to help us, because I understand the lawyers are having a difficult time.
Yeah, these days, mom and dad might cheer. You and I heard, you mentioned high standards earlier and high expectations. You and I heard an Atlanta Public Schools graduate and Morehouse College junior give advice on what he believes will increase educational attainment for challenged students. And he gave a three-point list. One of the items on his list was raise expectations, and he mentioned specifically that schools celebrate SAT scores that would be considered only average, maybe even mediocre by national standards. Do you agree with him that we should celebrate only those achievements that are in fact real achievement in the sort of larger national context?
I agree absolutely. As a matter of fact, I was smiling because what he was talking about, that celebration, no longer is taking place because the system has gone through such a sea change that what was once considered good is now really considered average. And I'm just tickled to death by the change in the expectations at all levels of our school system. I absolutely agree that we have to have our students understand what high standards really mean. We began the 21st Century Scholars Program 3 years ago, where we are sending students from some of our most challenged schools, high schools, to the small Ivies, Middlebury, Bowdoin, Holy Cross, Amherst, to name a few, Hampshire. And that first year, they came back that Christmas, during the holidays, and we had this, my senior team and their principals listen to their conversation. And they talked about how they had been considered high-achieving students in our high schools and had gone to these schools and really were up against a lot of challenges in keeping up, competing with kids who had come from other states or private schools. Now, those students have done extremely well, I want to say. They hung in there. Many of them are abroad this year. One's doing a full junior year in China. Another one's in London, and on and on and on it goes. They've all done very well. They've maintained a 3 or higher average in some of those very competitive schools. And we've had cohorts now every year since then. And every year since then, the complaints are less, meaning that the kids are feeling better prepared. Are we there yet? Not totally. But we are well aware that our standards must be competitive if our kids are to do well, because these are some very bright young people, and they are maintaining these averages and earning these very lucrative scholarships valued anywhere from $150,000 to $200,000, and they're competing. But they went in feeling less ready than many of their counterparts. And so we're working hard across our system to raise expectations, to have people really understand that our kids can rise to the standards and really, you know, make it and do well.
What changes would you like to see made in No Child Left Behind?
Let me say this, that I thought when No Child Left Behind was introduced that it was a good thing. It was a good thing because it focused us on looking carefully at all subsets of students, and that we could not ignore students and just look at the overall achievement of any school. Having said that, there were lots of issues with the actual implementation of No Child Left Behind, not the least of which is that we did not have the growth model. That is, measuring how a student would do year to year as opposed to looking how the average class has done compared to last year's average class on the same grade level. We should be using the growth model to assess growth and progress. I also believe that we need to have more incentives in addition to sanctions. No Child Left Behind was extremely punitive in terms of schools that are failing kids, and I believe that schools that are failing kids should be addressed, and we have addressed them, and we've done a lot of things before No Child Left Behind became law and with No Child Left Behind to end failing situations for kids, because that's not acceptable. But we also should be incentivizing schools and teachers and principals who do show progress and do show growth, and that was not a part of the law. Tutoring, the SES component, I felt did not work well at all. The providers were not vetted sufficiently. The school system did not have enough input into selecting the providers who they felt would be appropriate. I also believe that the English language learner requirements and the special education requirements were not appropriate and needed to be recalibrated, because we need to be fair to children who are coming in with English as a second language in terms of how much time they need to have before they are tested and sanctioned. So, I mean, I could go on and on into the details, but enough. I think the law in principle was a good law, but I think there were lots of parts of the implementation of the law that needed more input from the practitioner. And of course, lastly, the fact that we don't have national standards, that what's the standard in Georgia versus what's the standard in, let's say, New Jersey may be very different. It's hard to compare state to state whether or not kids are doing equally well. And we've seen a lot of evidence, kids who do well in one state, the state test, when they take the NAEP, they're doing very, very poorly as compared to other states. So I think all of those pieces are important as we rethink the reauthorization of the No Child Left Behind legislation.
Why did you choose education as a career?
I kind of fell into education as a career. I actually was an English major, and I was headed toward journalism school. And then that summer, the New York City had an aggressive recruitment for minority, quote-unquote, teachers to spend the summer teaching in their summer school programs alongside master teachers with the end in mind of getting them to consider teaching as a career. Not a lot different, believe it or not, for Teach for America. And so I was recruited along with a girlfriend of mine, and we said, look, this is a good way to make some money for the summer. We'll go, you know, we'll spend the summer in the schools, and then we'll head off to graduate school. And I was assigned to a junior high school, it was called at that time, middle school now, in New York City, alongside a fantastic teacher, and just fell in love with it. I just felt that this was what I wanted to do. I wanted to work with kids. They were middle school kids. I wasn't a whole lot older than some of them, and I enjoyed it tremendously and just changed my career path.
How should a superintendent's performance be evaluated? What's fair from the community's perspective?
Well, I have been very public with my the agreed upon goals and objectives with the board of here in Atlanta. First and foremost, I think we should be accountable for the improvement in student outcomes. A part of my performance compensation is linked to the percentage of kids who move from the bottom quartile to the middle and from the middle to the top in math and reading. It's linked to the percentage of kids who do well on advanced level courses. It's linked to the improvement in student attendance, very measurable, very concrete. And at the end of the day, this is what we're supposed to achieve. What everything else that we do are the processes we use, the initiatives we put in place, the people we hire, the budget that we recommend. Everything is supposed to, in the end, lead to improved student outcomes. If we don't do that, then we have to reassess all of those other things I just listed. And so I am comfortable with saying publicly that I believe that I'm accountable for improving the student achievement here in Atlanta Public Schools.
Just a couple of other questions. What is the greatest challenge to improving student achievement for which you have responsibility? In other words, let's take out the family situations. We know kids come to school with lots of problems, but let's take that all out and let's say you control certain things. What's the biggest challenge to improving student achievement that you control?
For me, it's teacher quality. To the degree that I control that, to the degree that I'm responsible for providing the professional development, the supports, the coaches. We know that we need coaches in our schools to help our teachers. The degree to which I can realign the budget and recommend to the board programs that will provide support in the schools, provide common planning periods so we can have professional learning communities where teachers can focus on data and instructional strategies and talk about student performance in a meaningful way. That's the biggest challenge that I have, making all of that happen and providing high-quality professional development to change the instructional strategies of the staff.
Education spending is usually the biggest item in any city budget. In fact, it's often bigger than everything else put together. A lot of people wonder, how much is enough? Is there an answer to that question?
I think you have to weigh the question against the cost to society when we don't educate kids. And the cost to society when we incarcerate young people. What is enough there? We can't put a dollar figure on that. We have to pay it. And so I think what we have to do is make sure that if we're spending the money, that there is a return on the investment. I think that's reasonable to ask. It's very difficult to just say it's $11,000 per student or $8,000 per student or whatever. You have to, I think, be prepared to justify what you're spending in a very clear way so people know what it's going for. The majority of the money should go to the schools and to the classrooms, and at the end of the day, you should see progress. I always say when the people who most object to us spending whatever we are spending per pupil in urban systems. And by the way, there was a study done recently, an independence that was independently funded by Gates, that showed that Atlanta's spending is in the middle of the pack when you compare apples to apples and urban systems to urban systems. We're right in the middle. When you compare what we're spending to what a parent is prepared to spend for a student coming from a very well-positioned family in terms of their economics, because often they're not that well-positioned in terms of some of the other things that are going on, but a family that is well-off financially will pay $20,000 per year, $22,000 per year in private school education, because they understand that at the end of the day, there'll be a return on that investment called admission to Harvard, Princeton, Brown, wherever you want to call it. And so we as a society have to decide, what is the cost realistically to prepare kids to meet those kinds of standards? Poor kids, kids who come in with about 400,000 words less in their vocabulary in pre-kindergarten than a child from a middle-class background. What do we need to pay to get that child to the finish line so they too can cross over and go to college, which we know will be required if they're to be successful? And then we will have a return on our investment. And you have done a lot of work on what that return will be for this society economically. So that's my answer, is that we've got to invest, but we should ask for a return on that investment.
Dr. Hall, congratulations on your recent honor, and thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Dr. Beverly Hall is the superintendent of Atlanta Public Schools. She's the 2009 National Superintendent of the Year, and she took time out of her very busy schedule to join us from WABE in Atlanta. There's more Smart City waiting for you online. Go to smartcityradio.com to download past shows, sign up for our newsletter, and get links to our guest work. You can subscribe to our podcast and have Smart City delivered straight to you. You can also get in touch with us by clicking on the contact button or send email to questions@smartcityradio.com. We'd like to know how we're doing. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. He misses BSG. I'm Carol Coletta.